Today is Wednesday, April 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. At least two are dead in street clashes in Chad as protesters call for civilian rule.
The military council had banned protests on Monday evening, saying they could lead to disorder at a time of national mourning.
Plus, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken takes a virtual trip to Africa.
We're very much committed to working with partners to advance peace and security in Africa.
We'll have these stories and more next. At least two people were killed and 27 wounded in street clashes in Chad on Tuesday between protesters demanding a return to civilian rule and security forces, prompting key ally France to condemn the crackdown. Tensions have been high in Chad since the sudden death last week of President Idriss Deby, who had ruled the impoverished desert country for three decades. He was killed on April 19th as he visited troops fighting rebels. A military council headed by his son took control of the country after his death, but is facing resistance from some Chadians who crave change after Deby's autocratic rule. Some opposition lawmakers describe what has happened as a coup. In a video sent to Reuters News by Lame Duchad, demonstrators in the capital of N'Djamena marched down the street, chanting, demanding a transition to civilian rule. Reuters' David Doyle has more.
N'Djamena resident Alassem Djimonyan said people had come out to demand freedoms.
They talk about democracy in theory, but on the ground there's no democracy. That's why people came out today, to protest and demand their rights, because we're fed up.
Djimonyan criticized the role of former colonial power France, which had justified the military takeover because of exceptional circumstances. France and DRC released a joint statement urging elections within 18 months. The military council had banned protests on Monday evening, saying they could lead to disorder at a time of national mourning.
Reuters reporter David Doyle.
Le Tchad a besoin de la communauté nationale et internationale.
Chad's transitional military leader, Mohamed Idriss Deby, says his country needs massive support from partners to stabilize an economic and financial situation that's been severely impacted by the security situation and the coronavirus pandemic. Deby, who took over after his father was killed, said in his first address to the nation that the military took over after the president of the National Assembly declined to assume constitutional powers. Deby described the country as being in ultimate peril. Nigeria's parliament called on the presidency, armed forces, and the police to address the country's mounting security crisis Tuesday, with the lower house urging President Muhammadu Buhari to declare a state of emergency. The resolutions come as a wave of violence and lawlessness sweeps across Africa's largest economy. Security forces, including the military deployed across most of Nigeria's states, have shown little ability to stem the tide of violence. In the northwest, gunmen have kidnapped more than 700 schoolchildren since December, as militants pillage communities in the region. And in the northeast, the armed forces are still struggling in a 12-year war with Boko Haram and Islamic State's West Africa branch. On Sunday, it was reported that more than 30 soldiers died in an attack. Now, this all comes as U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken on Tuesday made his first Africa visit, albeit virtually. Anita Powell takes it from here.
Protecting global human rights through good governance is a cornerstone of American foreign policy. And U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken hit those points hard in his opening event Tuesday with alumni of the U.S. government's Young African Leadership Initiative. But the casual nature of the virtual exchange, which he called 10 Questions with Tony, did not stop these young Africans from asking the U.S. new top diplomat some tough questions about everything from climate change to Chinese influence to growing extremism on the continent. It all comes down, he said, to this.
We're very much committed to working with partners to advance peace and security in Africa. In the short term, sometimes that looks like security partnerships, conflict mitigation support, and diplomatic advocacy on human rights. Ultimately, I think the most important thing that we can do is to help countries, where possible, strengthen their democratic institutions, strengthen the ability to deliver progress for people, economic growth, And that's the real foundation that we need to put in place.
The virtual nature of the visit meant that Blinken, from the comfort of his D.C. office, traversed huge distances in no time. After meeting virtually with the Yali alumni, he then zipped over to Nigeria, where he met with the president and foreign minister. And then, 90 minutes later, clear across the continent to meet with Kenya's president and foreign minister. He also spoke with officials in both countries about their efforts to battle the pandemic. He also did not shy away from discussing the virtual elephant in the virtual room, the U.S.'s largest adversary, which is making serious inroads in Africa.
Countries in Africa will and should engage with a broad array of partners, whether it's China or France, Turkey or Brazil, the United States, or many others. And my hope is that African countries and African communities just approach those relationships with your eyes wide open. China's a global competitor, and competition is a good thing as long as it's basically fair and the playing field is level. But as we look at it, we have different approaches to governance, we have different approaches to business, we have different approaches to security, and the fundamentals sometimes of our partnerships are quite different.
With this visit, Blinken could outpace his predecessor in terms of engagement on the world's fastest-growing continent. Under previous U.S. President Donald Trump, two secretaries of state visited Africa, once each. Blinken's staff says this visit will not be his last, and that he hopes to make an actual trip once it is safe to travel again. In the meantime, he said, he will play it safe and listen to the voices from the world's youngest population.
The most important thing we have is to hear and to listen to new voices, young voices, fresh perspectives, new ideas. No one has a monopoly on ideas, never mind good ideas. And as you're bringing these ideas to the marketplace of ideas, it's going to make for a much more powerful and abundant market. And I think that's the way we get progress.
Africa, Blinken said, the U.S. is listening to you. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Steve Miller. In India, COVID-19 infections continue to grow in a country that has already registered 17 million people as being infected. The Washington Post reports that more than 300,000 new cases were confirmed for the sixth day in a row on Tuesday. This week, India ordered its armed forces to help support the beleaguered healthcare system, and President Joe Biden says it will release 60 million AstraZeneca vaccines from the U.S. stockpile to the world, including India. Reuters' Matthew Laratonda brings us this story of unlikely heroes in India as the country continues grappling with surging cases of COVID-19.
I can only do what is best available to me at the moment, which is not much, to be very honest. It's not much. I can, at best, only try to help families reduce their load of running around looking for resources.
Sweta Dash, 28 years old, an independent journalist in India. And as India rapidly spirals, breaking worldwide records for coronavirus infections, hospitals turning people away, supplies running low, Dash and other volunteers have become unlikely heroes in an unlikely place. Twitter. Indians are increasingly turning to Twitter out of desperation, asking for people to help them find hospital beds for loved ones, oxygen canisters, etc. Dash does what she can.
It feels very overwhelming and it feels very absurd because, to be very honest, the crisis is huge and no one on the internet, at least I can speak for myself, is equipped to deal with such a crisis. It's not simply a medical crisis. At this point, it's also an emotional crisis. Because, you know, when I receive a request from a patient's family, somebody in distress crying that, hey, can you please help me with finding leads for a hospital or oxygen or something, and that person is crying, I'm not equipped to deal with that. Individual citizens are not equipped to deal with this crisis of heartache and loss and mourning and grief.
She isn't alone. In fact, there is one volunteer group called the Medical Support Group, which boasts about 350 members using hashtags like COVID SOS and spreadsheets to track resources. Results for these efforts are mixed. One success? A patient in Delhi who found the hospital bed and was showing signs of recovery because of the group. Sometimes help arrives in smaller gestures as well, such as home-cooked meals for patients quarantining at home, or just taking care of people's pets. Why Twitter? Facebook and WhatsApp are more popular in India, but it's easier to get the word out on Twitter because it's more public-facing, and the retweet function can quickly amplify a person's message. It can also turn into a flood, though. Enter Umang Galaya, 25 years old, a worker at a tech startup. He's made a website called COVID-19-Twitter.in that helps sort it all.
Twitter specifically, if I pick 100 posts from my feed, at least 95 of them will be about people looking for resources or people sharing resources. And these resources include ICU beds, ventilators, oxygen cylinders, contacts of people that could provide them, and things like that. It's difficult for an average user to use Twitter's advanced search for something like this. Well, they have to figure out all the keywords that they might need. They could just select things and then it forms a search query for them.
The word crisis is used to describe a lot of countries during the pandemic, but India is one of the worst. As Dash said earlier, volunteers like she and Galaya are doing their best.
Matthew Laratonda reports for Reuters News. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says fully vaccinated Americans no longer need to wear masks outdoors, with one exception. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani explains.
It's what CDC Chief Rochelle Walensky calls another step toward normalcy.
There are many situations where fully vaccinated people do not need to wear a mask, particularly if they are outdoors.
She says the exception is in a big crowd, like a stadium. The change comes amid hopeful signs. Drops in virus cases, hospitalizations, and deaths, increases in vaccinations, and data showing most virus transmission happens indoors.
If you're vaccinated, you can do more things more safely.
President Biden says more than a third of American adults are now fully vaccinated, and he hopes the new guidelines spur more people to get shots. Sagar Magani, Washington.
France and Germany are setting aside billions in pandemic recovery spending. The AP's Charles de Ledesma.
Under the recovery fund's formula, France should get around $48 billion, while Germany expects $36 billion in spending. Half the money for Germany would go to environmentally friendly projects, and a quarter to spreading the use of digital technology. The finance ministers of the EU's two biggest economies have underlined their joint determination to use the vast spending to transform Europe's economy and get the continent growing again as it lags behind the US and China in rebounding from the pandemic recession. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
3 days of UN-mediated talks are underway to try and unify the island of Cyprus, which has been divided between Greek and Turkish Cypriots since 1974. That was when Turkey invaded North Cyprus in response to a Greek-backed military coup on the island. Lisa Schlein is up next.
The Greek Cypriot and Turkish Cypriot leaders, as well as foreign ministers of three guarantor states, Greece, Turkey, and Britain, the former colonial ruler of Cyprus, will be holding so-called informal talks over the coming days. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres convened this meeting to test the waters, so to speak. His spokesman, Stephan Dujarric, says the aim of the meeting is to determine whether there is enough common ground for the parties to negotiate a lasting solution to the Cyprus issue within a foreseeable horizon.
The Secretary General will move forward based on the outcome of the informal talks. The parties are welcome to be creative, and the Secretary General will be encouraging them to move, to use diplomatic language in a sincere and frank manner.
The spokesman says Guterres will hold separate bilateral meetings Tuesday afternoon with the leaders of the two communities. In the evening, he will host a reception for the heads of delegations. On Wednesday morning, Guterres will host a plenary meeting with all five parties to be followed by bilateral meetings in the afternoon. There have been three attempts to reunify Cyprus since 2004. All have failed. The last attempt occurred in July 2004. 2017, 6 months after Guterres took office. Guterres took a hands-on approach to resolving this intractable issue, energized at the prospect of achieving a diplomatic win so soon after becoming the UN chief. 10 days of negotiations in the Swiss Alpine town of Crans-Montana also ended in failure. Dujarric says the Secretary General is unwilling to prejudge the outcome of the talks. He says this is an issue that Guterres knows well, as he has participated in discussions before. Dujarric says the Secretary General is neither cautiously optimistic nor pessimistic, but realistic. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Lebanese analysts are calling on the United States and the European Union to impose sanctions on their politicians, who they say are subverting the formation of a new government. The U.S. and France say Lebanon needs a new government of nonpartisan specialists who will carry out long overdue reforms and steer Lebanon out of its worst financial crisis since its 1975 to 1990 civil war. Dale Gavlak has more.
Lebanon's caretaker government hasn't yet met the required conditions for a World Bank $246 million loan for Social Security programs. Despite an upcoming deadline, continued political bickering is delaying the naming of a new cabinet, analysts say, and that means many poor and vulnerable families may not get the financial support they desperately need. Observers say the economic crisis is the gravest threat to Lebanon's stability since the 15-year civil war that ended in 1990. The U.S. Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, David Hale, warned earlier this month that Lebanese politicians could face punitive actions from Washington and its European allies if they continue to delay reforms. Professor Habib Malik of the Lebanese American University told VOA that the U.S. should step up pressure on entrenched politicians, whom critics describe as a mafia, by demanding the recovery of Lebanon's stolen assets and impose sanctions on them. Malik says the sanctions would also hit the Iran-backed Hezbollah militia.
Lebanon is hijacked and held hostage by a mafia militia cartel, which is beholden to Iran. The ultimate victims are the Lebanese people. The United States possesses a great deal of information about the stolen money. If the United States decides very seriously and methodically to start slapping some of these people across the board with the Global Magnitsky Act, that will put a huge dent, will weaken the mafia a lot, and it'll pull the rug from underneath Hezbollah's feet.
Nasser Sayedi is a former minister of economy and trade in Lebanon. He says billions of dollars of Lebanon's stolen assets need to be recovered from abroad. He encourages the U.S. and the European Union to work together on sanctions to target Lebanon's corrupt politicians and business elite to hold them accountable for what they've done.
Part of the sanctions is really part of stolen asset recovery, and that's worth, by my count, at least 20 to 25 billion. So we're talking about large amounts of money. Now that the Europeans have their own equivalent of a Magnitsky Act or something close to that, we can get some coordination, and then the politicians in Lebanon will feel the bite. And particularly as you start getting the beginning of a dialogue with Iran and telling Iran, you've got to hold Hezbollah back and let's get the reform agenda moving in Lebanon.
Beirut's Daily Star newspaper recently reported that France and the EU are putting together proposals that could see assets frozen and travel bans imposed on Lebanese politicians to push them finally to agree on a government to rescue the country from economic collapse. It said that many senior Lebanese politicians have homes, bank accounts, and investments in the EU and send their children to universities there, so a withdrawal of that access could strike corrupt officials hard. Hale told Lebanese officials that the time to form a government, not block it, is now, as is the needed comprehensive reform. Lebanon's currency has lost about 90% of its value. The government defaulted on its foreign debt last year, and nearly half of the population has been pushed into poverty and unemployment. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
China says Australia must abide by its One China policy after a senior government official in Canberra warned of conflict over Taiwanese independence. Under the policy, the Chinese Communist Party asserts sovereignty over Taiwan. Defense Minister Peter Dutton says a military confrontation involving China over Taiwan should not be discounted, but he insists Australia's focus remains on having good relations with Beijing. Australia does not recognize Taiwan as a sovereign state or regard the authorities in Taiwan as a national government. However, the United States has raised concerns about Chinese aggression towards Taiwan. Ethnic minority Karen insurgents attacked a Myanmar military outpost near the Thai border on Tuesday in some of the most intense clashes since a military coup nearly 3 months ago threw the country into crisis. The Myanmar military later hit back against the insurgents with airstrikes. The fighting took place as the junta said it would positively consider the Association of Southeast Asian Nations' suggestion to end the turmoil in Myanmar, but only when stability was restored. The outbreak of hostilities near the border shifted the focus of opposition to the junta away from the pro-democracy protests that have taken place in cities and towns across the country since the coup on February 1st. A local activist group says security forces have killed more than 750 civilians in the demonstrations.
This is Science in a Minute.
The male gorilla standing upright as he ferociously beats his chest can be considered one of the most powerful and fearsome experiences in nature. Motion pictures such as the King Kong movies made use of this very visual and audible method of male gorilla communication to terrify audiences for generations. While it's thought that a male gorilla uses chest beating to attract females and scare off any possible rivals, a new study led by researchers at the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology suggests that he is also communicating his body size as well. The German-led research team found evidence that bigger male gorillas produced chest beats with lower audio frequencies than those with smaller ones. Since it can be used to communicate an animal's ability to fight and compete in nature, body size is considered an important quality in many animal species. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. With this week marking 100 days of Joe Biden's U.S. presidency, Henry Woodrow reports on how the new administration is being viewed from across the Atlantic.
Even via video link, the transatlantic change in tone is palpable. Joe Biden's U.S. presidency has brought radical change to the alliance, and Europe has warmly welcomed the transformation, says analyst Leslie Vingemuri of Chatham House.
He wants to work in concert with America's allies and partners, and most especially those who are in Europe. So I think that that is, has been absolutely critical. And the fact that Biden's been so quick off the block to bring America firmly back into the key multilateral institutions and to really draw a line in a good way under America's commitments to climate and to health.
The United States has rejoined the World Health Organization and the Paris Climate Agreement. Biden's Secretary of State has twice visited Brussels, underlining support for NATO and the European Union. Washington has also joined talks aimed at reviving the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, which Europe sees as a triumph of its diplomacy. The former Trump administration withdrew from the accord, viewing it as seriously flawed. Biden also has taken a new approach with U.S. rivals, labeling his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin a killer and imposing two rounds of sanctions on Moscow. Pavel Sharikov is from the Russian Institute for U.S. and Canadian Studies.
The new sanctions were kind of more serious than the sanctions introduced by Donald Trump during the previous 4 years. And Russia saw that as Russia was frustrated. Russian government did not understand what was going on.
Meanwhile, Russia has sent over 100,000 troops to the Ukrainian border, widely seen as a test of President Biden. Larry Sabato of the University of Virginia's Center for Politics.
He knows that inevitably, Russia in particular, China and others will test a new president with a crisis or a confrontation that was unanticipated early in the presidency. And I think Biden decided to anticipate that and to move on the chessboard before the other powers did. He sent them a message that there's new leadership here.
In Moscow, Russians who spoke to VOA said U.S. relations have deteriorated under President Biden. Moscow resident Yuri said, "I quite dislike him because it seems to me he is quite aggressive in relation to Russia."
"I quite dislike him because it seems to me he is quite aggressive in relation to Russia."
Fellow Moscow resident Natasha said, "I know he is not very positive about Russia. That is the only thing I know."
"I know he is not very positive about Russia. That is the only thing I know."
With China, the Biden administration has accused Beijing of carrying out acts of genocide against the Uyghur population in Xinjiang province. China denies the accusations. This week, the U.S. president recognized Turkey's killing of around 1 million Armenians during World War I as genocide. Again, analyst Leslie Vinjamuri.
"It's a consequential decision. It won't make it easy. Either with Turkey when it comes to their Armenians or with China when it comes to Xinjiang to pursue the kind of cooperation that is also essential and also extremely important, not only for the world, but for the Biden administration. So it is complicated. And I think this is, you know, in some senses, what we're all waiting to see. You know, where will those trade-offs need to be made?"
For now, analysts say Biden is still enjoying a political honeymoon with European allies. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
A powerful public inquiry in Australia will investigate suicides in the military. Phil Mercer reports that officials say more than 400 veterans have taken their own lives since 2001, but that figure has soared in the past year.
The Australian investigation into suicides in the military follows a long campaign by former soldiers, their families, and politicians. A petition organised by a mother who lost her son in 2019, calling the issue a national crisis, is hoping authorities would intervene to save lives. The letter, signed by 400,000 people, calls for a royal commission, the nation's highest form of inquiry, to investigate systemic failures that result in suicide. Officials have said the rate of suicide of serving and former military personnel was unacceptably high. Such is the scale of the testimony the inquiry is likely to hear. The government is expected to appoint 3 commissioners to the investigating panel. It will probe a range of issues, including the quality of health and support services for veterans and how they make the transition into civilian life. Sarah Watson spent 18 years in the Australian Army and served as an intelligence officer in Iraq. She was later diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder and told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that life in the military could be unbearable.
"Thinking about those who I know who have been unable to fight their demons and taken their lives, and well, I know myself having been very close to that edge of ending my life, I know that at that point in time, you don't think there's any hope. I was on high alert. The whole time I was in Iraq, I felt unsafe."
Announcing the Royal Commission, Prime Minister Scott Morrison hoped it would be a healing process. He said it would approach its work with great sensitivity.
"We understand and recognise that some families and others may not wish to share their experiences, and the inquiry will be respectful of that. And given the sensitive and personal nature of the issues that witnesses may face, the Royal Commission will be authorised to hold private sessions."
According to figures published in October 2020 by the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare, 465 Australians who'd served in the armed forces had taken their own lives between 2001 and 2018. In contrast, the Defence Ministry says 41 Australian defence personnel died serving in the military during the 20-year conflict in Afghanistan. The Royal Commission's terms of reference have yet to be formalised. Royal Commissions are set up by Australia's Governor-General on the advice of the government, and its task is to make recommendations on matters of national importance, and the government determines when to investigate cases. It has the power to hold public hearings, call witnesses under oath, and compile evidence. One bereaved mother said, "Finally, families can stand up and share their stories, and the voices of veterans will be heard." Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. And until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.